Okay, now on to business. In a couple of minutes, we're going to talk to a former guest here at the Chris and Rob Show, Dr. David Grinspoon. He's going to give us an update on all the things that are happening on Mars.
Right.
There's two,
right.
Count them, not one, but two little Mars rovers. They're called Mars rovers. One's called Spirit. That was the first one. And the other one's called what, Jim?
Spot.
Spirit and Spot. Now, what's the other one called? Come on, dude.
Aren't these like cigarettes? Spirit? What is that? Mars Spirit? That's the name of a rover?
These things are rolling around on Mars, taking pictures, digging in the dirt, looking for drugs. And we're going to give Dr. Grinspoon a call here in a couple minutes. He's a NASA scientist. He's got a good sense of humor. And we're going to talk to him about all things Mars in just a minute.
You're listening to the Chris and Rob Late Night Talk Show.
Ain't that the truth? I'm Chris.
And I'm Rob.
And we welcome back at this point one of our favorite guests of all time. And we've had people on the show like Mario Cuomo and Jerry Lewis and the bass player from Led Zeppelin. But this guy's even cooler. This is Dr. David Grinspoon from NASA and Funky Science. What's up, David?
Oh, man, too much. It's just a dream week for those of us that are obsessed with Mars.
A dream week? What do you mean a dream week?
Well, it couldn't be better. We got three new functioning spacecraft at Mars, and we're learning all kinds of new things that seems every hour. The one that seemed like it was broken, now it seems like we've got a fix for it, and the new one, Opportunity, landed in the best possible place you could imagine landing on Mars.
Now let's backtrack for a minute and get our listeners caught up for the ones that don't watch CNN or Channel 23 where they show the NASA press conferences. A couple of weeks ago, the first of two little Mars landers landed, and it's called Spirit. And then about 3 days ago, the second Mars lander landed, and it's called
Opportunity.
Right.
All right, so let's backtrack still some more. When the first one landed, and it's called Spirit, and when everybody probably remembers it made a lot of news about 2 weeks ago when it landed, and there were some pictures on TV, and you got 3D pictures, so you got to have your 3D glasses on.
Right.
First of all, what did you think of those pictures? And second of all, what happened? How come we can't talk or communicate or get more pictures from that particular robot anymore?
Well, what I thought about the pictures is that they're just spectacular. You know, these opportunities come along so rarely, and here's a brand new landscape on Mars, and it looks really different from anywhere else we've had a lander, and that's just what you want, you know, a genuinely new kind of landscape. That's what we learned the most from. It'd be disappointing if it looked just like the other places, but it doesn't. As far as what happened, you know, at first I thought maybe it had been rover-jacked by some delinquent Martians. But it turns out that it was quite scary at first. We thought maybe there was some permanent problem, but now it's looking like it's a software problem that we can probably fix from the ground. It's basically like, you know, you got your flash memory card and your digital camera. Well, this thing has a flash memory that's very simple, and it seemed like the software running that flash memory basically broke. And if it's really the software, we can fix it. If it's a hardware problem, then we're screwed because you can't just go up there and replace a circuit board. But it's looking good now. It's looking like a software problem, and that's something we can fix from the ground.
Has it been fixed yet?
It hasn't been fixed, but I think they've narrowed down what the problem is. That's the first step, is to do tests and make sure you really know what the problem is so you don't screw something up worse when you try to fix it. I think now they're at the point where they're getting pretty confident as to where the problem is, and so the next step is to fix it. My prediction is that within a week, that puppy's going to be up and running again.
All right. You mean as soon as they get done taking the pictures of the face on Mars, then they'll show us more pictures of rocks and barren desert?
Exactly. They're those classified ones like that one you emailed me, but we're not really supposed to talk about that.
Here's the question everybody's been wanting to know, Professor Grinspoon.
Yeah.
Is NASA Windows or Mac?
Well, you know, most of the science, well, it's of course half and half. If it was all one or all the other, it would be too easy, right? A lot of the scientists I know use Mac for their day-to-day, you know, just kind of word processing, emailing, the easy stuff.
But so they can Photoshop. That way they got the Mac, they can use Photoshop and take out all the pictures of the Martians and the Martian temples and the ruins and the ancient Martian castles and make it look more like a deserted desert.
Exactly. Yeah, we got to remove all the really intriguing stuff because we don't want people to know too much.
I got you.
But so you guys use both?
Well, I mean, personally, I use Mac, but then for like the heavy duty computational stuff we do, we use sometimes we use Windows or sometimes we use other machines like these things called Beowulf clusters that are like supercomputers that aren't really Mac or Windows. They're Unix based machines. You know, so it really depends on what you're doing. There's all kinds of stuff. It would be nice if we were all in the same system, but, you know, name one big bureaucracy that ever works that efficiently, and, you know, NASA's no different. So, of course, we're on all different machines.
Well, let's get back to this whole Mars thing. We're talking to Dr. David Grinspoon from NASA. Check out more about him at funkyscience.net. Is that right?
Yeah, funkyscience.net or lonelyplanets.net.
Okay.
And actually, I've put together a new section of links of all the coolest Mars stuff. And that's if you go to lonelyplanets.net and click on links right near the top there. I've got all my favorite Mars sites where you can find the pictures, including the pictures that aren't always released to, you know, on the newspapers and stuff. And I've been updating that every day, so you can always find new stuff there.
Okay, and then the second lander landed, and we'll talk more about Spirit in a little while and how it might get fixed. But the second one landed, it's called Opportunity, and according to the news reports, it landed inside a crater.
Yeah, and that's just amazing because, you know, one of the things we hoped to do with this lander was find a crater that we could go down into, because you want to get down into a place where the rocks underneath have been excavated, so you're not just looking at the surface stuff that's blowing around the planet. You want to find the bedrock underneath to know what that landscape is really made out of. So we were hoping that sometime while the rover was still functioning, we would be able to find a crater we could drive into. Well, dang if we didn't land right into one. It's the absolute perfect landing spot. It was just a stroke of luck.
And what have we discovered about this crater and about the geology of Mars since we landed Opportunity into this big hole?
Well, you know, remember, Opportunity's just been there a couple days, so far we've mostly just been checking out the systems and making sure it's all working, and we haven't even rolled off the lander yet, and so most of the discoveries are ahead of us. But already we can see that we're in, yet again, a place that's very different from the Spirit site or from any of the other landing sites. The color, first of all, is really different. It's dark. It's a dark brown material. And we don't know what that is, but as soon as we get off the lander and roll around and scratch in the dirt, we're going to find out exactly what that stuff is. It's some different kind of minerals. And you notice in those first pictures there aren't any boulders, which is really weird. Everywhere else on Mars, there's covered with small boulders. So for some reason, this landscape, there aren't. But one thing that there is, which is really cool, is this exposed layer of bedrock. There's sticking right outside the wall of the crater. There's this sort of layered bedrock material, and that's the kind of stuff that, you know, that's the geologist's dream. That's what we've been hoping sometime on this mission we would find somewhere, is that bedrock to dig into. Well, it's sitting there about 10 meters from where we happen to land, so one of the first things we'll do when we get off that lander is roll over right up to that bedrock, stick our instruments right into it, and then we'll be able to figure out if that stuff is sedimentary, meaning it was formed by liquid water, or if it's ancient volcanics, you know. So we're going to learn a lot about the history of this place just by rolling right up to that bedrock, which fortunately is just right there where we landed, and figuring out what that stuff is made out of.
Now, when I saw the pictures, the first pictures that came back from Opportunity, the second lander that landed on Mars last week, I noticed that there were some pancake-looking splotches or some dirt splotches. Is that where the lander actually landed and bounced a couple times before it...
Yeah, that's from the impression that the airbags made in the dirt. You know, these things land basically by as they sense that the ground is near, they surround themselves in these airbags and they bounce. And you're absolutely right. Those weird splotches right near are the last places where the airbags were sort of dragging in the dirt, and they create these spots, you know, that just don't look like anything else, because in fact it's something that we introduced there with the landing gear.
So I looked at the spots and I thought they looked... Visibly, they looked like they were a darker color than the material around them. So whatever dust or whatever the lander knocked off there or blew off there when it bounced around. And second of all, I noticed, and if I didn't know any better, I'd say it looked wet. Am I crazy?
Well, probably. No. There is this strange appearance of stuff that looks wet and looks muddy at these landing sites, which is odd and which nobody's figured out exactly why. It can't really be wet, because we know the temperature there and we know the thinness of the air, and it's a place where you can't actually have liquid water because it would just instantly evaporate or freeze away. But there's something that's sort of like mud, and we don't know what it is. But again, this is one of the things when we get the opportunity to dig there in the dirt and stick our microscopes and our spectrometers and our other instruments right down there in the dirt, we're going to figure that out, what this stuff is. And, you know, this is the kind of thing that we live for in planetary exploration, is these new mysteries. So right now we're at the phase where we can see all this cool stuff and we go, well, this is weird, that's weird. We don't know what it is. You know, your guess is as good as mine, but we've got the equipment up there, and as long as it keeps working, we're gonna have the answers, and we're going to know what that stuff is.
How are you space-type professor, scientist, brainiacs getting along with the brainiacs who are usually crawling around in Montana looking for rocks? Because it seems like it's like very different disciplines, you know, like the guys whose minds are in the stars and in the clouds. Now you're working with guys whose minds are in the dirt.
Well, that's true. That's one of the interesting things about my field of planetary science is that it's inherently multidisciplinary, and you got geologists working with astronomers. You know, we have to work together to figure out the planets. It's sort of astronomy. It's sort of geology. And you're absolutely right. There is a sort of clash of cultures. You know, the geologists tend to drink a lot of beer, and astronomers tend to smoke a lot. Well, you know, I won't say what they do, but, they're different cultures. And,
Lucky strikes. You guys smoke a lot of Lucky strikes.
Yeah, a lot of Lucky strikes. That's it.
Everybody knows about Carl Sagan and the way he used to write in the soap on the wall in his shower. You know what I'm saying?
I wasn't going to bring that up. But, you know, and then now we got what we're calling astrobiology, which, again, not only is it planetary science where we're mixing astronomy and geology and all these things to try to figure out the planets, but now we got biology in the mix where we're trying to figure out extraterrestrial life. And when we get together in these meetings, it's really challenging because we all have our own jargon, you know, and we're not used to having to talk to other human beings that aren't schooled in our jargon, but we all have different jargon. Mm-hmm. So now when we have an astrobiology meeting, it's like we have to, all the different eggheads have to learn how to talk to each other in some sort of common scientific language, and then hopefully that makes us more capable of talking to other human beings who aren't even eggheads. So there's something kind of cool about astrobiology in that we're having to learn new ways to communicate just because all these people that are trained in different ways are having to work together to try to figure out, you know, this question of extraterrestrial life.
We're talking to Dr. David Grinspoon from NASA right here on the Chris and Rob Show. And what you were mentioning there about how the sciences have all sort of come together over the years is something that you mentioned in your new book called Lonely Planet, where you're talking about all the different ways of searching for extraterrestrial life, about how years ago you had astronomers and they had telescopes and that was about the end of that. But nowadays, you guys are studying planets and these different places, and so now you need to talk to geology experts, which astronomers aren't, and in some cases, biology experts, because you're hoping to find, you know, some little amoebas or something up there. And now you guys are having to get along with a bunch of other dudes and creating your own new fields.
Yeah, it's pretty challenging. In fact, that's why, you know, the book is called Lonely Planets, and the
oh, that was a good segue to the book, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Thank you for giving me an opportunity to mention that.
No,
the subtitle is The Natural Philosophy of Alien Life. And people say, well, why do you call it natural philosophy? Isn't it science? But the reason I call it natural philosophy is because it's almost like a return to what science was a couple hundred years ago when there was no science. It was just natural philosophy, which is like a branch of philosophy that studies nature. And there weren't all these separate disciplines of astronomy and biology and geology. It was just natural philosophy, and it was the study of nature as a whole. And one of the things that I think is cool about astrobiology is that it's getting all the different disciplines that were forced to talk to each other to attack this problem, and in a way it's almost like science is turning back into natural philosophy.
Well, let's get back to Mars here, but that's a damn good book plug. It's called Lonely Planets, A National Philosophy of Extraterrestrial Life, and you can pick it up at all the high-class bookstores around town or on the internet.
Or even some lousy ones.
Yeah, so check it out. But back to Mars, David. If you could write one headline that would focus on the biggest discovery of the past 2 weeks on Mars, would it be something that the Spirit found or something that the Opportunity found or something that the Europeans found at the South Pole?
I think, you know, the biggest headline so far is not something that we found, but something that we've done that's putting us in a position to make the great findings. And it's got to be that, what Steve Squires, my buddy who's in charge of the science team for the landers, he called it a 300 million mile hole in one. The fact that we landed in this crater, it's really phenomenal. It's like a dream. It's like what you would, if somebody could, you know, say, you know, I'm going to grant you one wish for this mission, it would be like, we're going to land in a little crater by a piece of bedrock. So that, you know, that's the story so far, but we've already seen hints of things. You know, at the Spirit site, we think we're seeing the spectroscopic sign of carbonate rock. If that turns out to be true, that tells us this really was a lake bed, because the only way we know to make carbonates is from rocks forming out of water. So we've got a lot of hints of really cool discoveries, but we're still very, very early in these missions. You know, we're basically just getting the equipment working and getting ready to roll across these landscapes. So I think most of the mind-blowing discoveries are ahead of us. And so the big headline so far is just that we've done it. You know, we've landed on Mars successfully. We've got working spacecraft, and we're getting to roll. We're getting ready to roll.
Now, I made a reference there to the European Space Agency. Tell me what they found at the South Pole last week and why that was in the news.
Yeah, actually, that's pretty cool, and it's really kind of a complementary effort to our landers. That the Europeans have this new orbiter called Mars Express. That's just, it took them a while to get into the right orbit, and now they're just starting to do science. And they have made this really cool observation at the South Pole, basically of water evaporating off the ice at that pole. And it confirms this suspicion that the South Pole might have a lot of water ice in it. And now they've basically seen with a spectrometer from that orbiter the signature of water ice evaporating. They basically proved that southern pole has a lot of water in it. It's just one more clue about the action of water on Mars in the past and even at present. And of course, you know, when we're interested in looking for life elsewhere in the solar system, we follow the water. So anytime we find a new confirmation of the action of water on another planet, that gets astrobiologists very excited.
What can we look forward in the next couple of weeks, assuming that they get Spirit back working and assuming that the other one, Opportunity?
Opportunity.
And assuming that Opportunity does what it's supposed to do, what can we look forward in the next couple of weeks as far as pictures or discoveries from Mars?
Well, it's going to get better from here on in, assuming that these things keep working and it looks like they're going to be able to fix Spirit, and assuming Opportunity stays healthy. Really, the good stuff is just beginning, because these are rovers, you know. That's what we've never had before. Okay, the Sojourner rover in 97, it was able to go a few feet, and that was kind of cool. It tested the concept of roving. But these ones are actually able to go, you know, miles, potentially. They can go over the horizon and see what's next. And so this is our first time really on an expedition on another planet where we don't know what's over that hill. And this is just starting, this part of it. So first of all, we're going to answer some of these specific questions about, okay, what is this soil made out of? You know, what are these rocks made out of? What is the geological history? And then as far as, that's the science that we're going to get, which is going to be exciting. But as far as exploration, we're going to drive out of that crater that we landed in, and we're going to see what's over the horizon, and we're going to say, hey, that hill looks really cool. Let's drive over there and see what the view is from on top of that hill. We've never been able to do this from another planet before. So just on the level of sheer exploration, this is, you know, the fun is really just about to start.
Well, a couple of years ago, there was another rover. I forget the name of it, and it landed up there.
That was the Sojourner, but it was really, and it was really cool, but it didn't really go far enough to, like, show you a new vista. It just went, you know, a matter of a few feet. And it was neat because we could drive up to some rocks and see what they were made out of, but it couldn't really take us over the horizon to the next hill.
So where's that at now?
It's just sitting there. It's dead, Jim. It served its purpose. It proved the concept of a rover. But in a certain sense, these are now fulfilling the promise of that mission. These are long-distance rovers. We're going to actually be able to do some traveling on Mars now.
Okay, so the Sojourner isn't working anymore?
No, that just had a lifetime of, I forget, but it was weeks. It was great. It was a great mission. We learned a lot. But that was really what paved the way for these guys, which are going to be able to travel much farther. They're larger. They got six wheels each, and they're designed to last at least 90 days each and travel, you know, a mile or maybe more.
Really?
Yeah.
Cool. Now, besides you, do you scientist guys get to decide where to roll it to, or can you, like, vote online and say, roll it over there?
Well, there's a group at JPL who is really, who are every day making the decision about what's going to happen the next day. But, you know, they're open to suggestion. They're in communication with the rest of the community. And if somebody has a really great idea and emails it in, they're gonna listen for sure. But, you know, there's a small group of people that are really calling the shots, which is as it should be. You know, in an operation like this, you don't want it to be too democratic about it. You want to make sure that, you know, that the right decisions are made and the thing's going
to
work.
Well, you know where Rob and I want you to go, make a go-to?
Do tell.
The face on Mars. We want you to roll right up the nose and check, pluck out a nose hair and examine it.
You know, that would be really cool. That's actually the reason we're not at a place like that is because the landing sites are, well, first of all, you have to land really near the equator because these things are solar powered, and the face on Mars isn't that near the equator, and so you need to be in a place with maximum sunlight. Secondly, you land in a place intentionally that's a little bit flat and boring because you don't want to die on landing. The face on Mars is in this area, the Cydonia region. It's very rough and bumpy and all these eroded hills, and so it would be a much more challenging place to land. I do hope that one of these days we get to live out your wish and climb up the face on Mars and crawl into those nostrils and see what's growing in there. But that would take much more advanced equipment than we have right now, simply because it's harder to land in that rough a landscape.
You know, this is just sort of a humorous aside, but they recently brought Art Bell back to the radio, and I heard him a couple of weeks ago when that thing first landed, and he was talking about Mars and all. And then he says, and I couldn't believe he said this too, because you know, he's usually so far out, but he says, you know, I've been looking at these pictures of the face on Mars, and I hate to say this, but if Mr. Richard Hoagland is listening, I think it's a bunch of rocks.
Art said that?
Art said that about 2 weeks ago.
More power to him. Hey, you know, I didn't know whether I should mention this or not.
You can mention anything on our show.
Believe it or not, tonight, from midnight to 3, my time, I'm going to be on the Coast to Coast radio show talking to the loonies.
Really? You're doing that tonight?
I'm doing it tonight, starting at midnight Mountain Time, which would be, I guess,
1 a.m. out here.
2 your 2? Time, till 5 in the morning.
So I got to work in the morning, but I will try to catch it.
If anybody listening has insomnia and they want to hear me blabbling on for hours tonight, I'm going to cook up a pot of coffee, and then I'm going to be on Coast to Coast tonight.
Well, what we need to do is come up with a code word, so if Rob and I or any of our listeners call you tonight, you'll know that they're from Chris and Rob country.
Oh, that's a good idea.
What should the code word be?
I think the code word should be nose hairs.
Nose hairs. All right, that's our code word, is nose hairs.
So just work that into the question somehow, okay. And then I'll know it's a Chris and Rob listener.
Are you going on with George Norrie tonight?
Yeah, that's right.
He ain't no Art Bell. He doesn't stimulate the listener like Art does.
Yeah, I'm not that familiar, to tell you the truth, but I'm looking forward to it. I'm really looking forward to it. I think it'll be fun. It seems like they have a good sense of humor, so, you know, what's not to like?
Okay.
I just have a couple of real quick questions for you.
Yeah.
One's like a nuts and bolts type question.
Sure.
You told us last time that the rover's not going to launch off of Mars and come back here. So how can you tell what a rock is made of, a million miles away?
Yeah, well, we have instruments that are designed to do that. They're called spectrometers, and they look at the wavelengths of light and of other kinds of radiation really carefully. And the clincher, the reason we can tell that we're seeing what we think we see, is that we have those exact same instruments here on Earth in laboratories, and we test them on rocks of all different varieties. And so we've gotten really good at recognizing the signature of different rocks in those spectrometers. So, you know, that's basically it. We have these remote instruments, but we practice with them on Earth until we get, you know, that we've just gotten to be really good at identifying different kinds of minerals and rocks with those instruments. So, yeah, I mean, we can always be wrong, but I think the people that design these things, and they've got a lot of experience, they're pretty darn good at recognizing specific rocks and minerals, and so that's how we do it.
Because I remember my first lab practical at Bowling Green State University, I was supposed to identify these 35 rocks. And you got 35 guys picking up the same piece of rock and licking it. You got guys scratching rocks with their fingernails and all that stuff. Then you got guys like me just cheating off the girl next to them.
NASA hired.
Well, then at a party after I failed the lab practical horribly, then at a party this girl's all drunk and she tells me how smart I am.
Oh.
And I was like, well, I was cheating off of you, you moron, and we both failed.